Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Kenyan forces pulled out of two towns in southern Somalia Tuesday, and Islamic extremists quickly moved into one of them, according to residents. The Kenyans' withdrawal came after an attack by Islamic extremists who claimed to have killed many Kenyan peacekeepers recently, according to residents Tuesday. The town of El Ade is no man's land now after Kenyan troops started withdrawing early Tuesday and headed toward the Kenyan border, according to a resident. Ghanaians have reacted strongly to the transfer of two Yemeni detainees held for more than a decade at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to the West African country. However, President John Mahama said the men posed no threat and would be monitored.
We have had several sessions with the Americans. People went to Guantanamo and personally interviewed these people. And I believe that we don't, our security is not endangered because they are in our country.
Ghana's government has granted permission for the two to remain in Ghana for 2 years, subject to security clearances. However, many say the presence of the detainees pose a security threat to Ghana, which has so far evaded the Islamist threat in West Africa, targeting Mali, Nigeria, Cameroon, and most recently Burkina Faso. U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker and a slew of American business executives are meeting in Nigeria to encourage trade they say will create jobs on both continents. The visit to Nigeria is expected to be among the top 10 economies in the world by 2050 and one of Africa's smallest but most innovative nations. Rwanda is designed to transform the perception of Africa from an aid-independent country. VOA News. Pope Francis met with the Iranian president Tuesday, joining a cordial discussion which touched on the recent nuclear accord and Iran's role in the region. President Hassan Rouhani met first with Francis privately for 40 minutes and then later with other officials. The Vatican, in a statement, said the conversation delved into the nuclear accord recently taking effect and the important role that Iran was called to play to combat terrorism along with other countries in the region. The Vatican described the talks as cordial. After the meeting, Iran's president asked Pope Francis to pray for him. The World Health Organization says it suspects a link between the mosquito-borne Zika virus and a rare birth defect that gives babies abnormally small heads, but says so far the evidence is circumstantial. This is the WHO Director General Margaret Chan.
Although a casual link between Zika infection in pregnancy and microcephaly has not, and I must emphasize, has not been established, the circumstantial evidence is suggestive and extremely worrisome.
And that is the WHO Director General Margaret Chan. A WHO spokesman, Christian Lindmeier, said the UN agency plans a special session Thursday on the virus during a Geneva meeting of its executive board. Paris police fired tear gas and taxi drivers lit bonfires on a major highway Tuesday amid nationwide strikes and protests over working conditions and competition from non-traditional services such as Uber. This is the president of the internet website Taxis de France. He says in two words, what we want is either eradication or compensation. Simply, there's no arguing about it. There's no more negotiation. So either the government bans private chauffeur-driven cars or give us compensation. It's that simple. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, met with taxi drivers in an apparent attempt to diffuse tensions and condemned the drivers' violence, but promised to strengthen a police crackdown on the competing taxi services the drivers are protesting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrives in Beijing Tuesday. It's the last stop of his Asia trip, with territorial disputes in the South China Sea looming as a likely talking point. Before his visit to China, Kerry also made stopovers in Laos and Cambodia. That's two countries where Beijing's influence runs deep and Washington is looking to expand ties. Officials in Afghanistan say a policeman suspected to have links to the Taliban killed 10 fellow officers Tuesday in the central province of Uruzgan. The pre-dawn violence happened at a security post in Chinartop district. The rogue policeman drugged his colleagues before shooting them dead. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Economic activity has been paralyzed in Chad and northern Cameroon following frequent Boko Haram attacks on trucks transporting goods from Nigeria's Borno State to the two Central African nations.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. Details coming up.
Also in the news, casualty figures from yesterday's suicide bombings in far northern Cameroon have risen, and Al-Shabaab militants seized two key towns in southern Somalia after AU troops withdrew today.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, casualty figures from yesterday's suicide bombings in far northern Cameroon have risen. Officials say four bombers attacked two towns, killing at least 35 people and wounding 65. Cameroon officials say the attacks occurred in Ashagashia and Bodo near the Nigerian border. They blame the Nigeria-based extremist group Boko Haram. Cameroon's Minister of Communications says the military carried out raids into Nigeria from Ashagashia, killing at least 17 insurgents.
Economic activity has been paralyzed in Chad and northern Cameroon following frequent Boko Haram attacks. The militants have targeted trucks transporting goods from Nigeria's Borno State to the two nations. During the latest attack, suspected Boko Haram members diverted three trucks transporting goods to Chad through Cameroon to an unknown destination. This marks a change of strategy after the terrorist group started targeting mosques in Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena.
Nafisatu Aja, sales agent at Arab Supplies, one of the most popular shops in N'Djamena, says she still waits to be paid last month's salary as the shop has not received supplies from Nigeria's Borno State for several months. She has not been paid because business is slow due to regular attacks on the shop's supply trucks. 45-year-old truck driver Tokba Haman says he no longer travels to Nigeria for supplies because the Boko Haram terrorist group targets trucks and kills drivers.
On voit toujours il y a des manifestations dans les villages voisins.
He says, as the terrorists continue to control Nigerian villages, seizing goods and killing traders, especially around Borno State, business activity will continue to decline in Chad, even with the heavy presence of the military along roads and markets. Chad's customs official, Abdul Said, says three business establishments lost their trucks last Saturday to Boko Haram insurgents in the Nigerian town of Gamburu, which is separated from the Cameroonian town of Fotokol by a 500-meter-long bridge.
Beaucoup de véhicules ont été attaqués par Boko Haram.
He says many vehicles have been attacked and seized by Boko Haram in the past 2 weeks. He says in the most recent attack, the insurgents drove three trucks loaded with goods destined for northern Cameroon and the Chadian capital N'Djamena to an unknown destination. N'Djamena lies less than 50 kilometers from Nigeria's northeastern Borno State, the stronghold of the radical Islamist movement. Chad and northern Cameroon have supply routes originating from Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria, which is the center of Borno State. The goods are brought in through Gambaru and then Fotokol on the Cameroonian side to Kuseri and N'Djamena in Chad. Lawmaker Abakabir of Cameroon's National Assembly says economic activity stagnates in northern Cameroon and Chad because the insurgents are still in control of supply routes from Nigeria. He says if the border road linking Fotokol in Cameroon and Gambaru in Nigeria continues to be controlled by Boko Haram, economic activity will continue to be paralyzed in Chad, northern Cameroon, and parts of northeastern Nigeria. He says their plea is for the military to liberate the road from Boko Haram attacks. Basic goods and manufactured items like portable phones, farming tools, and spare parts for vehicles are imported to Chad along these routes. After troops from Cameroon and Nigeria launched raids on Boko Haram strongholds and drastically reduced their firepower, the insurgents resorted to suicide bombings on mosques and hit-and-run attacks on trucks transporting goods. Landlocked Chad and northern Cameroon also rely on maritime trade from the Cameroonian port of Douala on the Atlantic coast. But supply trucks are also regularly attacked in northern Cameroon by the insurgents. Chad today increasingly relies on its northern neighbor Sudan for supplies, but instability in Sudan's western border and its spillover to Chad is destabilizing both countries. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, N'Djamena.
Al-Shabaab militants seized two key towns in southern Somalia after AU troops withdrew today. VOA's Somali service reports Kenyan forces have left Al-Ada and Badhada towns in Gedo and lower Juba regions, respectively. Al-Ada was the scene of a deadly Al-Shabaab attack on January 15th. Al-Shabaab said it killed over 100, but Kenya military officials deny the casualty figure was that high. Some reports say Kenyan troops withdrew because they claimed water wells in the towns had been contaminated.
The longtime president of Congo, Brazzaville, has been nominated for another term in office. Reuters reports the ruling party has once again officially named Denis Sassou Nguesso as its candidate. He served as president for 31 of the past 36 years in two separate periods. He's expected to easily win re-election in a poll that is considered a formality. Mr. Sassou Nguesso is one of a number of African leaders who've acted to extend their time in power, including those in the DRC, Burkina Faso, and Burundi. The moves have triggered protests and unrest in those countries. In related news, the African Union summit underway in Addis Ababa is expected to address the situation in Burundi. Violence has killed hundreds of people in Burundi and caused 250,000 others to flee the country. The theme of this year's summit is the African Year of Human Rights. The AU wants to send 5,000 peacekeeping troops to Burundi, something President Pierre Nkurunziza has strongly rejected. He reiterated that stance on Friday, despite reports from South African officials that Mr. Nkurunziza might reconsider. South African President Jacob Zuma may soon join mediation efforts to restore peace in Burundi. When he was deputy president, Mr. Zuma played a big role in getting Burundian leaders to sign a peace agreement in 2000 at the end of the seven-year civil war.
A new political party has been formed in Zambia this week, the Democratic Front Party. Its leaders include some members of the ruling Patriotic Front, including Miles Sampa, a former deputy minister of commerce in the current government. He also competed to be president at a ruling party convention in November, but lost. VOA's William Eagle speaks with reporter Alexander Mutale in Lusaka about the reasons for the split and what it may mean for the country's political scene.
At the moment, when Sampalo was launching his political party on Saturday in the night at a private place, he gave the following reasons for his resignation. I quote, "My decision came about as a result of the intolerance, hate, vengeance, and violent conduct towards party members, including those who supported me at the Kawe Convention in 2014. As a firm believer of peace and democracy, I feel a number of people were not and have not been accorded the right to express themselves freely. And that in itself has created disharmony from within. My efforts to unite the party have proved futile over the last 12 months. The current PF in looks and conduct reminds me of the MMD of 2011 and instilled fear in the general public. I choose to disassociate myself from such a grouping and wish them well. End of quote. Let me just explain some points here. After the death of President Sata in 2014, a convention was held within the ruling party to choose a successor. And Sampa was one of the eight that contested, but he eventually lost to the current president, Edgar Lungu. And during the elections, because the ruling party didn't have enough time to organize themselves, they worked very closely with the former ruling party, Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, which offered them a lot of votes, especially in the Eastern Province. Now, what happened after the elections is that Edgar Lungu and the Patriotic Front retained power, and most of the people from the government, which was deposed by the ruling party, was brought back into government. And this is what Sampa is referring to when he says that the current Patriotic Front Party reminds him of the MMD, which they deposed in 2011. And also on the point of some people not being given a right to express themselves freely, especially those who supported him. He was referring to those people who supported him at the 2014 convention.
How many other legislators or parliamentarians have left the ruling party to join him in the DFP?
There are no parliamentarians that have resigned from their positions to follow Sampa. But we expect to see some defections to Sampa's party in May when the president dissolves parliament ahead of the elections.
Has anyone else joined the DFP?
Yes, so far we know of the former deputy secretary general of the ruling party, who was present even at the launch of the party. And in addition, it was a fully packed hall launch. Many people were there from the Copper Belt where the party was launched. So he is a popular person among the members of his constituency and even across the country.
What has been the reaction of the ruling party and others to this, the creation of this new party and this defection of at least some members or former supporters of the ruling party to the new DFP?
The ruling party's reaction has been to discredit Sampa's move. They have labeled him as a non-entity, that he's not a factor, and that he's just a branch that will wither because it has broken away from the main tree, which is the ruling party. So they don't have any kind words for him, except to try their best to discredit him and to make him look like he doesn't know what he's doing.
That was reporter Alexander Mutale in Lusaka, Zambia. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
A Reuters news agency reports the Constitutional Court in Central African Republic has annulled the results of the nation's December 30th parliamentary election. It says it found some irregularities in the vote. However, the court has certified the two highest vote-getters in the presidential election for a runoff on February 7th. They are former prime ministers Anicet Georges Dolgweli and Faustin Archange Touadéré.
Authorities in Zimbabwe are holding four men, including two army officials and an opposition leader, on charges they plotted to bomb a dairy farm owned by President Robert Mugabe. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare for VOA.
On Tuesday, police refused to comment on the four, saying they are facing charges of, quote, possession of weaponry for sabotage and money laundering for terrorism purposes, unquote. According to court records, when the four men aged between 29 and 37 years old were arrested, petrol bombs and alcohol, among other things, were found Friday at Mugabe's farm about 30 kilometers north of Harare. Police said the suspects confessed to planning to bomb the president's dairy farm. Takura Jangaja is an independent political commentator in Zimbabwe.
In terms of the general political narrative in Zimbabwe, usually there are such cases that emerge every now and then, and a lot of trials that emerge around allegations of treason as well as undermining the authority of government. What might be surprising is its origins as well as the areas in which it is alleged to have occurred, close to the first family's residence or business properties.
That was an apparent reference to the fact that in Zimbabwe, all first families' residences, businesses and properties have 24-hour security. There was no word on why the men wanted to attack the president's farm. Mugabe supporters seized hundreds of farms from white owners in the early 2000s under what the government called a land reform program to address colonial-era imbalances. The four suspects, who allegedly held several meetings to raise money and plan the bomb attempt, are scheduled to appear in court on February 8. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Humanitarian agencies are appealing for $550 million to address Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. The UNHCR, the International Organization for Migration, and 65 other groups are asking for the funds. About half of the $550 million would be allocated to Greece, which has been the main arrival point. About 1 million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe last year. About 850,000 of them crossed from Turkey to Greece. In other news, the Czech Republic will host a summit on migration next month. Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia have been invited to attend. All four countries have rejected the European Union's plans for migration quotas.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In much of North America and Europe, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersexual community now enjoys equal civil and human rights. But in much of Africa, they continue to be ostracized, jailed, and even killed for their sexual orientation and behavior. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Joseph Tolton, the Bishop of Global Ministries for the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries, or TFAM. It's the largest faith-based African-American organization dedicated to empowering the LGBTI community here in the U.S. and in Africa.
There has been a real politicization of homophobia in Africa. There are many governments that are now lifting up the gay issue to create a sense of moral panic among Africans, and they use that moral panic to distract Africans from focusing on the issues that really matter, issues of poverty, issues of economic justice, issues of corruption. When you look at places like Kenya, where over the last year there has been so much reported about how deep and corrupt the Kenyan system is, the political system and the banking system, it's the corruption that breeds the poverty. And the anti-LGBT issue is an issue that the government has been able to present to people where they know that they can win. It gives the people a perverted sense of being empowered and victorious because you give them a very weak opponent. What's really interesting about the Anglophone countries, countries that were colonized by Britain, is that most of these countries have holdover anti-sodomy laws, which speak to issues of sexual conduct. But importantly, these laws were not being enforced for many years because there was no particularly anti-gay sentiment or anti-gay hostility within the populations or even coming from the government. It has only been since the gay issue has become a political factor in Africa that this issue has become so salient and so important.
You mentioned Uganda.
Absolutely. So the Ugandan parliament debated a law that basically said the anti-sodomy laws that we have are not enough. We've got to go further. We've got to create laws that clearly make homosexuality punishable by death. And let's go even further by creating a law that will mandate that all Ugandans must report or turn in anybody who they perceive to be LGBTI. And if you do not, and the authorities know that you have contact or knowledge of that person, you yourself will then be sent to jail. What has happened in Uganda is that they've created the gay issue to distract the population from the issues that really matter to allow people to maintain power.
What is the state of affairs in other places?
Interestingly, if you go to South Africa, you have legal protections in the Constitution for LGBTI people, but you've got a lot of ingrained social resistance to those protections. South Africa has one of the highest rates of corrective rape. Lesbian women are raped at an incredibly high rate. It demonstrates and articulates this grave disconnect.
But what about West Africa?
West Africa is very interesting. You have countries like Liberia, which have a real deep relationship with the Western conservative Christian communities. So places like Liberia are particularly homophobic. But then there are places like Cote d'Ivoire, which is much more open and does not have any anti-sodomy laws. There is no push for such. So certainly you have some cultural resistance. But Cote d'Ivoire, Togo are places where you'll see a little bit more openness. A place like Ghana, we would put probably somewhere in the middle. Ghana has real kind of Western aspirations culturally and really looks to the West. Places like Mozambique, they just passed a law which makes same-sex conduct legal. In Botswana, which is in Southern Africa, they have passed a law which will allow LGBTI groups to legally register. So it's a little bit of a patchwork moving from one country to the next.
What about North Africa? You know, obviously that's sort of more of a Muslim region and definitely Arab.
The North African case is distinctly different. Tunisia, being much more secular than some of the other North African countries, a lot more tolerance. But Egypt, which for many years, I think because of its influence from Israel, to be very honest, just kind of had a look the other way policy. Interestingly, after the Arab Spring, they've actually seen a real pushback and a retrenchment of LGBTI rights in Egypt. Once the military stepped in, there was just a real crackdown. But again, that retrenchment to many levels is based on the fact that when you have that kind of a clamp down, you're clamping down on the openness for democratic spaces to emerge. And therefore, LGBTI spaces experience that. The connection is this. Naturally, gay and lesbian people look to the West because here is where we are most free. That becomes very intimidating to governments that don't want to see any openings for any kind of democratic reform or democratic aspirations among their population. There's this idea that gays are fighting for what? For gay rights. And that gay rights are very much so about human rights. And then you've really got a social mess on your hand because those human rights have got to be articulated. And that's what the government has a real fear of.
That was Bishop Joseph Tolton of the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries, a U.S.-based organization which advocates for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersexual communities in the United States and Africa. Bishop Tolton spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the upcoming presidential runoff elections and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests analyze the ballot. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Casualty figures from yesterday's suicide bombings in far northern Cameroon have risen. Economic activity has been paralyzed in Chad and northern Cameroon following frequent Boko Haram attacks. And Al-Shabaab militants seized two key towns in southern Somalia after AU troops withdrew today. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC and our feature segment, The Highest Court in All Constitutional Matters in Zimbabwe has outlawed child marriages. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with African football today.
Kim, Guinea and Tunisia posted victories Tuesday to advance to the quarterfinals at the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. In Gisenyi, Guinea edged the Super Eagles of Nigeria 1-0. On a goal by midfielder Ibrahima Sori Sankon just before halftime. Meanwhile, in the capital, Kigali, Tunisia trounced Niger 5-0. Saad Bagir had two goals for the Tunisians, while Ahmed Akachi, Ali Maloul, and Hisham Asifi completed the scoring in the big victory. Tunisia and Guinea finished on top of Group C with 5 points each, but the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia finished in first place based on a +5 goal difference compared with Guinea's +1. Nigeria had 4 points from 3 matches, and Niger had 1 point. Meanwhile, the last quarterfinal berth will be at stake Wednesday when Group D action wraps up in Rwanda. Zambia will meet Mali in the capital, Kigali, and Uganda will go against Zimbabwe in Gisenyi. The Chipolopolo of Zambia already have clinched a place in the quarterfinals after victories over Zimbabwe and Uganda in their first 2 matches. The Eagles of Mali, with 4 points, need only a draw against Zambia to advance. The Cranes of Uganda, with 1 point, must beat Zimbabwe to have any chance of going through. The Warriors of Zimbabwe lost their first 2 matches and will be playing only for pride on Wednesday. Zimbabwe had high hopes when this tournament kicked off, so the team's elimination is a bitter disappointment for the country's football fans. Reporter Michael Cariotti tells us more from the capital, Harare.
Excited Zimbabwe football fans pegged drinking places Saturday to watch their team play, only to be disappointed after the Warriors missed a glut of chances before crumbling to a 1-0 defeat to the Eagles of Mali. The defeat saw the Warriors in rock bottom position on the 4-team table without a point after 2 games. With Mali on 4 points and Zambia having qualified on 6 points, the Warriors have no chance of qualifying for the quarterfinals, even if they win their last game against Uganda, as they will only end up on 3 points. However, there is no agreement on what really caused the Warriors' fall from grace, with all sorts of theories being drummed up. Some say the Warriors' preparations were shoddy. Others say Zimbabwe does not have quality players, while another school of thought is of the opinion that Kalisto Pasua is not the right man to coach the Zimbabwe Warriors. Soccer fan Bevan Gonese feels the Warriors were not good enough for the tournament, adding that the Zimbabwean team was put in its rightful place.
Don't have quality players. It showed our players are not good. Our coaches need to examine some of the players to take young players from Division 1 also.
Football analyst Farai Kambamura says the Warriors' performance justifies the means as the Zimbabweans did not prepare well enough for the tournament.
The performance of Warriors was shoddy. It was poor. And we can contribute that to poor organization. They say if you fail to prepare, you'll be preparing to fail.
The Zimbabwe Football Association did not organize even a single friendly match for the Warriors prior to the start of the tournament. A member of the Zimbabwe National Soccer Supporters Association, Witness Masocha, says it is wrong to point fingers at the coach and his players. He says Zifa badly let the team and the nation down.
I think their preparation was very, very weak. They did not do much preparations. And precisely, I think I'll blame it on the Zifa. They should have actually entertained those guys to go out and play a more challenging game.
However, there are others who have extended the debate to Coach Pasua, whom they are questioning whether he's the right man to handle the Warriors or that he's overrated. According to the state-controlled Herald newspaper, Pasua said he would have done better than settling for the wooden spoon in Rwanda, where he featured mostly young players that is grooming for the senior squad. He partly blamed the loss to poor preparation for the tournament, as his squad did not have some warm-up friendly matches. But Gonese says the results of the African Nations Championships clearly expose Pasua's shortcomings at such a high level of football competition.
Pasua is good at the club level, but not at the national team. We need to improve. Maybe we can find someone who can do better outside the country.
Warriors fan club member Tongisai Matapure says Pasua failed in his team selection and did not give the team the technical direction it required. He says the most honorable thing for Zifa is to fire Pasua before Zimbabwe faces more disasters. The Warriors are now in danger of finishing the tournament without a single point, as there is no guarantee that they will overcome Uganda on Wednesday. Gonese says, judging by their performance in the two matches they have played so far, the Warriors are unlikely to beat the Cranes of Uganda.
We have not scored a goal. How do you expect us to beat Uganda?
The Warriors are now shifting their attention to the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, in which they are joint top of their group along with Swaziland. After two rounds of matches, the Warriors have 4 points, the same as Swaziland, while Guinea and Malawi have a point each. Only one team from the group qualifies for the finals to be held in Gabon. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Still with the African Nations Championship, Cameroon is looking forward to a quarterfinal match Saturday against Ivory Coast after topping Group B. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon finished with 7 points after victories over Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo and a scoreless draw against Ethiopia. For reaction to Cameroon's performance, my VOA colleague James Buddy called Yaoundé, where he reached the editor of This Is Sports newspaper, Franklin Byrne.
Naturally, it's a reaction of joy. Especially, I would say it begins with surprise, because in as much as we were, this is Cameroon, this is also the Indomitable Lions in that category. Our team started the competition rather slowly. It's true that they opened with a victory, 1-0 against Angola, but it was a lackluster victory. And then they had this draw against the lame duck of the group, Ethiopia, in the second game. So So facing the giant, so to say, of the group in the last game, this decisive game, DR Congo, was a kind of a tall order for the Cameroon home-based national team. But see how surprisingly it turned out that we walloped them 3-1. And not just a victory, but a beautiful victory with wonderful football and three wonderful goals that you would hardly see even with the classical indomitable lions of Samuel Eto'o and Rigoberto.
Did you say, Franklin, that this is a home-based indomitable lions?
Yeah, this is a competition that the Confederation of African Football, CAF, created to give some credit and to give some visibility to the home-based players. This is not the Africa Cup of Nations, the equivalent of the European Nations Cup or the Copa America, as you can say. This is the competition, the tournament of African nations' home-based players who otherwise would only be seen in the national leagues, which are not very much in the public view, not very much in the media. Or they could be seen in the African club competitions like the African Champions League or the African Confederation Cup. So this competition is there for home-based players to have a chance to play international football with other nations.
What are the chances that some of these players, that they can make the Indomitable Lions the main national team?
There is a great chance. Just like, let me just give you an anecdote. Somebody after the Indomitable Lionesses, the women's national team has been doing so well on the international scene. You know, of course, that they emerged the best female national team in Africa when doing the CAF Awards earlier this month. So Cameroonians have been saying it looks like the next time the Indomitable Lions have a game, we'll rather feature the girls to play for us. I think that same feeling can take hold now. I'm sure that we'll begin to feel like the home-based player should rather represent us in the classical international competitions in place of the Indomitable Lions of Chukwu Moting, of Stephane Biya, of Abubakar, because the guys have really proven to have stuff in the legs. And I'm sure I can bet that when we get to get a new national team coach chosen, because we're still searching for one, it's supposed to be out any of these days, maybe in the coming weeks, I'm sure that that coach will have to consult with Ntungumpile if he's not going to be the one appointed to that position. And if he's not going to be one of those to assist the new coach who may likely be an expatriate, I'm sure that coach is going to consult Ntungumpile. And I'm sure that those on the shortlist are watching this competition for players they may need to use in the coming competitions with the Indomitable Lions, because these guys have proven to be really good.
That's Franklin Byern, the editor of Cameroon's This Is Sports newspaper. And Franklin was talking with my VOA colleague James Buddy from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Finally, in pro basketball, the defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors crushed the visiting San Antonio Spurs Monday night, 120-90, in a meeting between the NBA's two top clubs. Star guard Stephen Curry once again led the Warriors with 37 points, including 6 3-point shots. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, South Sudan's Ministry of Education trying to reduce the extremely high number of children not attending school. And Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court outlaws child marriages. But first, here's some music. Pepe Kale of the DRC with Zuki Zuki.
Lokasa ya mbongo Oya dola Ya paso de Ma
Pepe Kale, DRC, with Zuki Zuki. In South Sudan, a Ministry of Education official says the government will work with aid agencies to reduce the extremely high number of children not attending school in the region. A report released this month by the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says South Sudan is home to the highest proportion of out-of-school children in the world. More than half of primary and lower secondary age children are not receiving an education. Mugume Davis Rawakarinji reports from Juba that a lack of funding and insecurity contribute to their educational problems in conflict zones.
Lopuke Lotiam, Undersecretary of the Ministry of Education, says children's education in South Sudan was bad even before the conflict broke out in late 2013. Lotiam says the government is planning to increase the education budget to help rehabilitate schools destroyed by the 2 years of fighting.
There is a commitment of the government to put more funds in education, and also another strategy is to mobilize the communities in terms of local contribution. Because if you think of funding to build a classroom, you need to involve the people. You need to ask the people their contribution, whatever they can.
Only 6% of South Sudan's budget is allocated to education. The Ministry of Education uses much of that money to pay the salaries of officials. The UNICEF report says a severe lack of funding is to blame for the high school dropout rate and the woefully inadequate number of qualified teachers in South Sudan. Lotiam says even before the conflict began, the government was aware of the problem. UNICEF's education officer for South Sudan, Fun Nguyen, says the conflict in Unity, Lakes and Jonglei states has affected many children.
We find that due to the fact that schools were closed, schools were occupied by armed groups, schools were closed because of the lack of operational maintenance and budget, schools were destructed, occupied also by not only armed groups but also by IDPs. All of these reasons contributed to the number of children who had to drop out. And of course, poverty.
Win says poverty is a huge problem in South Sudan. Between 2013 and 2015, Win says more than 800 schools were destroyed. Win says the government and other aid agencies must make education a top priority. She says attending school not only prevents children from becoming fighters for various militia groups in the country, but allows them to learn life skills.
Life skills against protection against gender violence, how to wash hands, how to maintain their health, how to avoid mine risk, and so forth. So not only do children have a sense of normalcy when they go to school, but also the fact that the environment itself is protecting them from safety, from harm. So they are much safer in the classroom than not, especially adolescent boys and girls, adolescent boys who may be recruited into armed groups and armed forces.
Lopoke Lotiam says with the help of the United States Agency for International Development, his ministry was able to construct 350 learning centers for 400,000 children across the country. Kenya International, Save the Children, Oxfam and other international agencies are working with the Ministry of Education to give South Sudanese children an opportunity to go back to school after facing years of violence across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court, the highest court in all constitutional matters in the country, has outlawed child marriages. It has decreed that any person who intends to get married should be at least 18 years of age. Thomas Cherepasi reports from Harare.
The ruling follows an application by human rights lawyers who wanted the legal age of marriage to be moved to 18 for both men and women. The case was filed by former finance minister and leader of the People's Democratic Party, Tendai Biti, and two minor children. Following the court's ruling, Biti, who is also a lawyer, described the judgment as an important milestone in the protection of women and children's rights.
Well, I think the court has passed what I can only describe a revolutionary judgment for women and for girl children. The declaration that with that customary law, with in terms of religious rights, no person below the age of 18, man or woman, can get married. I think it's an amazing judgment.
He added that he was not happy that the legislature was taking its time to align several laws to the new constitution so that women and children's rights were protected.
Well, Parliament should have done this many years ago. They had over 36 years to do it. They didn't do it. So it has taken a bold decision from a bold court to do this. So it's a great day for women.
Reacting to the ruling, prominent human rights activist Justina Mukoko of the Zimbabwe Peace Project said that enforcement of today's ruling is going to be easy without the realignment of other pieces of legislation, arguing that the national constitution supersedes any legislation.
Well, in this regard, my understanding is that from today on, if anyone does anything to the contrary, they are going to find themselves on the other side of the law. And I think probably the other thing that we need to consider is that we are putting too much effort in terms of the realignment of laws. And somehow, I think the argument that is also coming up is that that is to result in us not focusing on things that need to be done, because we are all looking at the realignment of laws. But when you look at the Constitution, it does say that it is the supreme law that supersedes all other laws. So I think that should guide us in our way of dealing with things in the future.
Mukoko urged rights activists focusing on women and children's rights to launch massive campaigns to ensure that all the country's citizens are aware that child marriages are illegal and unconstitutional.
I think a spade just needs to be called a spade. And I know that my colleagues in the women and children's sector have worked tirelessly for this. And I think this should really clear the way for them to launch campaigns that will ensure that in the future we do not have children who are married off.
Angela Machonesa of Plan International said they are happy with the ruling.
As a child rights organization, today we join millions of girls across Zimbabwe in celebrating this landmark ruling. There is now no justification for child marriages. There is now no hiding behind culture, religion, or any other issue to perpetuate child marriage. The Constitutional Court, with its mandate to administer the supreme law of the land, has set the tone with regards to child marriages. Therefore, our future generations, especially girls who are at risk of child marriage, have now been protected by the law.
Some activists say many children were being forced into early marriages because of poverty, while some parents were covering up for statutory rape by forcing their children to be married to their abusers. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply alarmed by reports, including those from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, of serious human rights violations and abuses in Burundi, including eyewitness reports of mass graves, a sharp increase in alleged enforced disappearances and torture, and reports of sexual violence by security forces. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said these and other reports further underscore the urgent need for the government of Burundi to allow for the immediate full deployment and unimpeded access of African Union human rights observers to investigate these allegations. It is imperative that the government of Burundi remove all bureaucratic and practical roadblocks it has used to prevent the AU human rights and military observers from fulfilling their mandate for the past 6 months to investigate reports of violence committed by any side in the conflict. The United States, said Mr. Toner, calls upon the government of Burundi to permit an immediate, impartial investigation into these recent allegations and to hold accountable all those found responsible for crimes. The United States remains concerned about Burundi's ongoing political and humanitarian crisis and the resulting suffering it has brought to the people of Burundi. We once again call on all parties to reject unlawful violence and reiterate that the only way to resolve the crisis gripping the country is for all parties to agree promptly to engage in internationally mediated, inclusive dialogue without preconditions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer.
Get up.